second class now, and talking about the historical reliability of the Bible, focusing primarily, I believe, for most of the class, certainly for now, on the New Testament and the historical record of the Gospels and Acts, is what we'll be looking at for the next several weeks in that regard. And I want to look at the external evidence for the authenticity of the Gospel history. This is going to be the first of at least two classes that cover some of this external evidence. I'm not entirely sure how long it will take. I'm almost certain there's no way I'm going to get through my notes just for tonight. So since I planned on a second class at least anyway, hopefully we can get through it all in two classes, but we may have to I hate to say drag it on, because I don't really think that's the nature of this kind of information, but it may take a little bit longer to get through all of this, which is good news, because there's just that much evidence for the Gospels being authentic that it takes that long to get through all of just this one category of the information. So we'll be working through that. But before we begin, let's have a prayer together. Our Father, we're so thankful to you for this day and for this time that we have to come to study your Word and study about your Word. Father, we ask that we would consider the evidence that you have left for us, that it would build our faith and our trust in you, that ultimately our confidence would not be in the evidence that we see, but in your Son and the sacrifice that he made for us and for our sins. For we know that it is the gospel that is the power of salvation, not our reasoning ability, and not any clues that you have left behind. Help us to put our trust in him and that gospel story. Be with us and help our faith to increase through this series of studies, and help us to have the answers so that when we are asked for the reason for our hope, we can defend the faith as we ought. It's in your Son's name we pray. Well, a good verse that we could begin this class with.
First, we could begin just about any of these classes with. You find in 2 Peter chapter 1. And it's the kind of verse that when you think about it and the way that the skeptics talk about the Bible story has a little bit of irony to it in how they think about it. But in 2 Peter chapter 1 and verse 16, Peter says, "For we did not follow cleverly devised myths when we made known to you the power and coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, but we were eyewitnesses of his majesty." And so Peter says, it's not just a bunch of myths we followed. It's not a bunch of cleverly devised stories that people came up with that we followed, but we ourselves were actual eyewitnesses of the story of Christ. And what we'll see over the course of these lessons is that the gospel accounts in the book of Acts have that ring of truth that eyewitness accounts have. These are not stories that were made up later on. They certainly didn't come about 150 years later in a different part of the world. These are very clearly eyewitness accounts of what happened in the first century, and that's something that is virtually undeniable. But one of the things that makes it ironic to think of it in this context is you have kind of two opposing views that the skeptics want to put on the apostles and the gospel documents. One is that these are, to use Peter's terminology, cleverly devised myths. That these people all somehow worked together in order to foist this fake story and trick everybody into thinking that this all really happened when it never did. And they're very shrewd in how they tricked everybody to believing these things. And at the same time, they also want you to believe that they're a bunch of complete, bumbling, incompetent authors that don't know their right hand from their left. They don't know anything about anything, and they're constantly getting things wrong. And those two things are, I would suggest, fundamentally opposed to one another. Either they're complete morons or they're geniuses. They can't be both. They can't be bumbling, you know, buffoons that can't get the information right and at the same time be so smart as to deceive everybody for 2,000 years. And so the critics themselves are opposed to each other, but what is a very good answer to the information we find is that they were eyewitnesses and they wrote down what they saw. And to give you a little bit of a roadmap of where we're going, this is going to be basically what we're looking at in terms of the Gospels and Acts over the next several weeks. We'll look at both the external evidence for the authenticity of the Gospels and Acts, and the internal evidence for the authenticity of the Gospels and Acts. And if you weren't here last week, what I mean when I say authenticity is the general historical reliability, the trustworthiness of those documents. And we'll look at each of those in two ways, both the positive evidence that we have from outside the Bible. We'll look at non-Christian sources today, and we'll begin to look at incidental confirmations, things that are not designed to be evidence for their reliability, but when you weigh them against what we know of the ancient world, it shows them to be very reliable time and time again. Then we'll look at internal evidence. First, these undesigned coincidences that we've alluded to already. It'll be a few weeks before we get to that. And then some other clues to their authenticity. That's kind of a catch-all category. I know that's not a very helpful category, but we'll see that as we get to it. And then we'll come back and look at the objections that are raised by the skeptics. First, looking at alleged historical errors. Here's all the places the gospel authors got the information wrong. Well, we'll look at several of those to see if those objections hold any water. And then we'll also look at alleged contradictions within the gospel. So we'll look outside the gospels and Acts and inside the gospels and Acts from a positive perspective and from a negative perspective. And at the end of all of that, I think you're going to be extremely convinced that we can trust these documents as relaying to us an accurate history. Something that's going to come up in the midst of all of this are two things that we're going to talk about, and I'm not quite sure where I'm going to place it all yet because it doesn't really fit into any of these categories precisely. One is the issue of miracles themselves and whether or not miracles can happen. They're contrary to science and all of that kind of thing. So we'll talk about that. And then we'll come back and we'll talk about the miracle. And when I say that, I mean the resurrection of Jesus. And we'll talk about that in a historical context as well. And all of that will probably take, like I said, several weeks to get through. And once we're done with that, we'll kind of reevaluate where we are. We'll talk, hopefully, we'll have some time to talk about some Old Testament historical reliability kind of information as well. But that's where we're going, starting in the upper left quadrant and working our way as you would read a book, left to right, top to bottom. So that's where we're heading. So when you talk about the two kinds of external evidence that we're going to be looking at in this class, you've got, first of all, these non-Christian sources that give us confirmation of major events. So, for example, you can read in an extra-biblical source about a guy named Jesus who was crucified in the first century. And there is some level, at least, of extra-biblical confirmation that Jesus was crucified. So that kind of thing we'll talk about. And then we'll also talk about these incidental allusions in the Gospels and Acts that show us the author's knowledge of the setting of what's going on. It shows us the truthfulness of their accounts in recounting matters of detail, how incredibly accurate they are about things, which just bolsters their trustworthiness in general. And now when you look at these two different kinds of things, the non-Christian sources can be obviously pretty easy to recognize the connections, and sometimes it can be pretty dramatic when you think about the kinds of things that are said. There's one example I'll mention later that I'm not really going to use because it's more of a debated sort of thing, but if it was definitively what the guy was talking about and you could definitely connect it to the gospel, it'd be a very dramatic kind of piece of evidence. I'll mention that later. But how many of them there are, how specific they are, is going to depend on the author of the work. So Josephus is a name you've heard of before. He alludes to things that happen in the Gospels, but his purpose is not to record what's going on in Galilee between AD 30 and AD 33, and so he doesn't get into a lot of detail about that. So his purpose or his interest in what's going on is going to sway what value there is in that kind of testimony. The survival of the works sways the value of the testimony. One number that I've heard is that just from second century writings that we know about, so based on ancient bibliographies, ancient book lists, of just the documents that we know existed, we have lost to the ravages of time some 85% of writings from the second century that were written. They're just gone. We're never going to have them. And that's just what we know about. So you add all the other writings that we don't know about, and you know, what is the percentage of writings that we're never going to find? It's a huge number when you think about it. So, you know, what kind of extra-biblical testimony you can get from non Christian sources. It'll depend on the interest, the purpose of the author, the survival of the works, those kinds of things. And what you have to do is you have to hope there's overlap. You hope that as you're reading Josephus, that he's going to say something that relates to the Bible and you can find some verification there. Now, the second one, these incidental confirmations, these incidental allusions that show the author's knowledge, that show their accuracy and their dependability, they may not be as dramatic, but they ultimately, I think, make a stronger argument for the authenticity, because the purpose of these gospel authors is not necessarily to record a detailed, accurate history for historical purposes of the Greco-Roman world of the first century, but what they show us is that every place we can check, these authors were habitually truthful and extremely well-informed. And if every place we can check along the lines, they are accurate in incidental kinds of details, that should give us confidence that they are accurate in other things as well. And we'll look at a variety of those. And the strength of that argument isn't that you read one of these and it's just going to bowl you over and say, well, I'm completely convinced because they knew the geography of Palestine. I mean, that's not, you know, I believe in Jesus because they knew the geography of Palestine. That's a ridiculous expectation. But after you see about two dozen of these things, you think, wow, these guys really knew what they were talking about. And it's the cumulative force of that kind of accuracy that is a powerful argument, as we will find. So that's kind of where we're going. So we'll start with these non-Christian sources and talk about a few of them, beginning with Josephus, because he's the most well-known, and there's probably the most to say about, in particular, one of his pieces of testimony, the one that is most famous. Josephus was a Jewish historian. He was born in A.D. 37. He wrote after the Jewish-Roman War, and he worked for the Roman Emperor Vespasian. He is a little bit of an interesting character historically because of his Jewishness and his Roman employment and the fact that he's writing about the Jews from that kind of context. But be that as it may, he says a couple of things that intersect with the Bible, starting with this pretty famous quote about Jesus. So we'll come back and talk about those bolded phrases in a second. But Josephus says, "About this time there lived Jesus, a wise man, if indeed one ought to call him a man. For he was one who wrought surprising feats and was a teacher of such people as accept the truth gladly. He won over many Jews and many of the Greeks. He was the Christ. When Pilate, upon hearing him accused by men of the highest standing among us, had condemned him to be crucified, those who had in the first place come to love him did not give up their affection for him. On the third day he appeared to them restored to life, for the prophets of God had prophesied these and countless other marvelous things about him, and the tribe of Christians, so called after him, has still to this day not disappeared." Well, this is a favorite quote of Christians for pretty obvious reasons, as you might expect. Is there anything that's striking to you about this passage? In particular, the bolded parts?
Why wasn't Josephus a Christian?
Right, you know, Josephus is a Jew. If this is what Josephus believed, why wasn't Josephus a Christian? I think is the obvious question that has to be asked. And basically, Jewish and Christian scholars alike, down the line, say, some Christian scribe got a hold of Josephus and plugged a few things in there. They just couldn't resist themselves when they were copying Josephus. And that's how the manuscripts have come down to us. I mean, if indeed one ought to call him a man, that does not sound like something a Jew would say of Jesus. Such people as accept the truth gladly. He appeared to them restored to Christ. And of course, right in the middle, he was the Christ. That is not at all something that Josephus would have said, almost certainly. And so a Christian scribe probably did a little of interpolation here along the lines, and that's how we got the quotation as it is now. But does that mean that it has no value whatsoever? Well, again, if you talk to Jewish and Christian scholars alike, what they will tell you is, as a whole, the passage is authentic. Let me give you another way of thinking about this passage from that kind of context. This is the Mona Lisa, sort of. You might notice that she has a goatee. So clearly, this is not the painting that was done by Da Vinci. So what do you conclude when you look at this? You say, well, there must have never been a Mona Lisa. There was no such person as Da Vinci. He never painted anything called the Mona Lisa because somebody put a goatee on this painting. Do you conclude that on the basis of this painting being altered? Or do you presume that the painting as a whole is what Da Vinci drew and then something was added by a later hand? And you look at it and it's pretty easy to identify what that thing was. And so you erase the mustache and you're left with what was original. It's pretty simple to work through that very complex logical conundrum of the Mona Lisa with the goatee. Well, I would suggest that the same basic process applies to Josephus' quote. Most of it is pretty clearly authentic as something that Josephus would write, and there are some parts that are just about as fake as a goatee on Mona Lisa, and it's obvious which parts are. And you ignore those parts, and you go with what is the authentic part. I should have included it, but there's been an Arabic manuscript that's been discovered of Josephus that reads basically identical to the quote I just had without the Christian parts in it. And so there's at least some external evidence that Josephus wrote the part that you would expect to have been written by Josephus. So with that as our backdrop, what do we know about Jesus from Josephus? Well, we know that he was a martyred leader of the church in Jerusalem, that he was a wise teacher, I'm going to get this right in a second. A wise teacher who established a wide following is what I'm trying to say. We just had that conversation today, didn't we, Tom? That was a different thing, I guess. So, wise teacher who established a wide and lasting followers. He was crucified under Pilate at the instigation of some Jewish leaders. So you have the basic framework of the story of Jesus conveyed through Josephus. Josephus also talked about John the Baptist. Wow, that's small. We don't need to read all of this, but talking about John the Baptist, he says, "Now, some of the Jews thought the destruction of Herod's army came from God and was a very just punishment for what he did against John called the Baptist. For Herod had him killed, although he was a good man, and urged the Jews to exert themselves of virtue, both as to justice toward one another and of reverence toward God, and having done so, joined together in washing." And if you kind of skip down a little bit, if you can see that at all, you see Herod, who feared that such strong influence over the people might carry to a revolt, and then further down, so John, out of Herod's suspiciousness, was sent in chains to Machaerus, the fort previously mentioned, and there put to death. And you have the basic John the Baptist story. We'll come back and talk about this a little bit more in a few moments, because what is striking is the motive that Josephus attributes to Herod. You have the basic story of John being killed by Herod, but he attributes it to Herod's fear over John's influence leading to a revolt, Herod's jealousy, Herod's suspiciousness, those kinds of things is what Josephus thinks led this to happen. The biblical story is a little different. We'll come back and talk about that. But here, the basic value, John was martyred at the hand of Herod. Antipas is the Herod in question in Josephus. He was a teacher who attracted a large following. And so again, you get this biblical character alluded to as well. Tacitus is next. He was a Roman senator who wrote in the early 2nd century. Speaking of the fire in Rome, he says, "Nero fastened the guilt and inflicted the most exquisite tortures on a class hated for their abominations, called Christians by the populace. Christus, from whom the name had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilate, and a most mischievous superstition, thus checked for a moment, again broke out not only in Judea, the first source of the evil, but even in Rome." And so Tacitus tells us that the spread of Christianity was based on a historical figure named Christus, or Christ. He was crucified under Pilate during the reign of Tiberius. That Christianity originated in Judea, ultimately spread to Rome, and that there was enough of a multitude of Christians in Rome by AD 64 that he could affix to them a blame and persecute them in some specific detail. Suetonius and Pliny are... Yes, sorry.
Mysterious superstition. Was, yeah, superstition.
the most mischievous superstition, I think, refers to Christianity itself. But I think it implies the resurrection because it was checked for a little while and then broke out again. And so he killed Jesus, and that stopped it for a little while, but then it broke out again a month or so later, basically, would probably be the way they would talk about it. And so something happened between those two things, and I doubt Tacitus would ever say Jesus rose from the dead, but it does fit into the basic biblical pattern of that. Thanks for asking. I should have stopped. Any other questions about this or Josephus? All right, we'll kind of talk about the sum value of all of this in a moment. Suetonius and Pliny. Suetonius was an early second century Roman historian. His testimony is much briefer. He says, because the Jews at Rome caused continuous disturbances at the instigation of Crestus, Claudius expelled them from the city. And so here you find confirmation of what's going on in Acts chapter 18 when you remember Priscilla and Aquila are kicked out of Rome by Claudius in that decree. And so Suetonius is confirming that happened. You've got confirmation of the story in Acts there. Pliny says Christians were in the habit of meeting on a certain fixed day. He's another Roman senator. He was a contemporary with Suetonius. In the habit of meeting on a certain fixed day, and they sing in alternate verses a hymn to Christ as to God. And here you find that Christians had regular assemblies, a certain fixed day, which we know is certainly Sunday, first day of the week, the day of Jesus' resurrection, and that they worshiped Christ as a deity. Now, the one that I didn't put up here is a fellow named Thallus. We don't have any original manuscripts of Thallus, but he's quoted in Julius Africanus, if I remember correctly, and he talks about an eclipse or a darkness which is attributed to an eclipse on a certain year, which actually is AD 33 by our reckoning. But it's a debated quote, and not everybody agrees that Jesus was crucified in AD 33, so it's a little bit hard to pin down exactly what the value of that is. But if Thallus did say that, if he was talking about the darkness that coincided with the crucifixion, if Jesus was crucified in AD 33 at that same time, then you would have a external confirmation to a darkness that covered the whole earth at the time of the crucifixion. That would be a very dramatic piece of extra-biblical evidence, but there are just too many question marks attached to that one to say this definitely is extra-biblical testimony to this event. But it might be. So I mention it at least in passing. One other thing that I could mention is the Talmud, the Jewish writings. They mention Jesus. They condemn him as a false Messiah. So Jewish writings of a later period also speak of Jesus as a messianic figure, although, of course, they don't believe that he was the Messiah. So you look at all of this, and you put all of this together, and what this extra-biblical testimony tells us is that Jesus was a Jewish teacher, that many people believed that he performed healings and other kinds of miracles, casting out demons. Some people believed he was the Messiah. He was rejected by Jewish leaders. He was crucified by Pilate during the reign of Tiberius. His followers believed that he was still alive. They spread beyond Palestine. They met in a certain day. They worshipped him as God. There were multitudes of them in Rome by AD 64. The Jews were kicked out of Rome, as Acts records, and a few other things along the line as well. And you put all that together, and you've got a pretty good composite sketch of the New Testament story. And that's a remarkable thing because the vast majority of these historians, like I said, were not interested in Nazareth of Galilee in AD 30 to AD 33. That's not on their radar. Historians write about, huge things. Josephus, when he's writing the Jewish War, he's writing about the Jewish War, the Jewish-Roman War. That's kind of the focus. When he's writing his Antiquities of the Jews, maybe there's a little bit of room in there to talk about this Jesus figure, but that's not really his main focus. Historians writing don't deal with some bizarre prophet in the backwoods of a country that's really not that significant. Yet you have all of this information from Jewish historians, from Christian historians in the Gospels, and from Roman historians. Basically, everybody that had any connection to this land whatsoever said something about Jesus. And all of it is in line with what the gospel accounts say. And together, again, it paints a pretty good basic composite picture of the gospel story. Does it tell you everything the gospels say? No. Does it verify every detail of the gospels? No. But considering how remarkable it is that these authors say anything, it really is pretty powerful testimony to the basic story of Christianity. Yeah, and ultimately, this kind of evidence that we're talking about in this class is not going to prove who Jesus was. What we're trying to accomplish in a class like tonight is prove that you can trust the gospel author's story. And once you have confidence in their story, then you listen to them. And they're the ones that tell you about Jesus and who he was and what he did and him rising from the dead. And that's going to, you know, it's going to raise some other questions as you talk to skeptics about, you know, can the resurrection happen? Can miracles happen? Those kinds of things. But generally speaking, broadly speaking, at this point, the argument isn't Jesus rose from the dead. The argument is, can we trust these guys' stories on the most fundamental level?
Yeah, it really should go without saying that no historical document can have everything it talks about verified. Externally.
Right.
But that's one of the ways in which people treat the Bible differently. We'll only accept a historical statement of the Bible if we can find some verification of it. But other documents are not treated that way. And so we wouldn't expect every single story, every single statement of the Bible to find a verification externally. Like you're saying, it's incredible that they talk this much about Jesus, given how insignificant a figure he is according to skeptics. But like you say, it's important that they're caught telling the truth when you can verify it. It's just like the empty tomb. It doesn't prove Jesus was resurrected. But if you didn't have an empty tomb, you couldn't have a resurrection.
Right.
And so you can't prove that the gospel writers tell the truth every single time. But in the way times we could catch them, we can't. You know, they're proven telling the truth. And so you say, well, in these cases where their evidence is the only evidence I have, do I trust them or do I dismiss what they say?
Anything else at this point? Well, one other thing before we begin to look at these other kind of incidental allusions, which is what we'll spend most of our time talking about, is to think about what we have in the Gospels in comparison with a lot of other, main world religions or other, maybe not even the main ones, but with the Gospels, what you have is the biographies of Jesus written within a generation of his life, the ones written by Christians. So Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are all written within that generation. Within 100 years, you've got half a dozen other historians basically mentioning him along the way. The scriptures that show the teaching of Jesus are all written within a generation of his life. And you think, what the skeptics will say is, well, it's been 30 years before Matthew writes his gospel after Jesus is alive. That's a really long time for people to mess everything up. But you don't run into that kind of objection in other things where, you look at something like Zoroastrianism, their scriptures, this dates back to 1000 BC is when this religion began. Their scriptures weren't written until the 3rd century AD. The most popular biography of Zoroaster was written in AD 1278. So you're talking about 2,000 years between his life and the biography. Buddhism, the scriptures weren't put into writing until after the Christian era, although it began in the 6th century BC. The first biography of Buddha was not written until the 1st century BC. So centuries pass between his life and his biography, and those scriptures being written down. Islam began in the mid-500s. The Quran goes back to Muhammad's time, so their scriptures actually are with the founder of the religion itself, but his biography wasn't written down for another 130 years after he was alive. You talk about these main religions and their followers and their scriptures, and you compare it with Christianity, and it's unparalleled. How close it is to the time of the founder of the religion that the scriptures are written down and the biographies are written down, both by supporters and enemies and people who are really kind of disinterested, except that he's mentioned along the way somewhere. It's unparalleled how close in time it is. And that's something else that, you know, just by comparison, it should give you some confidence in the writers for that regard. All right, anything else about this external information? Like I said, it's pretty straightforward what they say and what you can get out of it. It's not as interesting to me as the other part, which is why I want to spend more time on it. And the other part gets us more in contact with the Bible, too, so that's a good thing. All right, these incidental allusions, again, what I'm talking about are places where the gospel authors are writing and they mention something, and it's not their main point in writing to tell us a specific detail about history or geography or whatever. They're just mentioning it because it's part of the story, and we can check it and find out how accurate they are. Again, this evidence is not going to be overwhelming in any single piece of it, but together it creates quite a convincing case for their general accuracy, their reliability, their trustworthiness, really from beginning to end. One of the things that makes this so valuable is because of how much we know about first century Palestine. We don't know that much about most of the world at that time of history. We know a lot about first century Palestine, thanks largely to Josephus. And it was a very odd time in the first century in Palestine because it was kind of double ruled both by the Jews and by the Romans. There were a lot of double things going on that wasn't normal. There was double taxation. The Jews taxed the people and the Romans taxed the people. There was double administration of justice. And so there were Jewish courts and there were Roman courts. There was double military command. So the Romans were wandering around with their guards. The Jews had their temple guard. And all of that you find reflected in these documents. And that's not the kind of thing that someone that's unaware of that time period is going to get right. That by itself is remarkable, that the authors know those things. They know that Jesus would have both a Jewish trial and a Roman trial before Antipas and before Pilate and before the Sanhedrin and just going back and forth. If someone's making this up 150 years later, there's no way they're going to get that kind of information right. But the gospel authors are right about that. And then just the political situation in general. Just from 6 BC to AD 44, there were really five different ways that the region was ruled. It begins with a single united kingdom under a native ruler. So Herod the Great is in charge in 6 BC when the story begins. After that, there is a set of principalities under tetrarchs or ethnarchs. So you think of Philip and Antipas and Archelaus, who are in charge of the region for a while. And that quickly gives way to it being part a Roman province and part a principality. And so you've got Antipas, who is still the tetrarch ruling where he was before, but Archelaus has been kicked out, and Pontius Pilate is in charge down in Judea. Well, that gives way to, again, it being a single kingdom under a native ruler when Agrippa I is in charge. And for the first time since Herod the Great, he is the sole ruler of that region, of course, under the Roman people as well. And then after that, it's reduced wholly to being under Rome. It's governed by procurators that are dependent on a higher figure in Syria who is dependent on the Roman emperor. And that's where you have Felix and Festus and Agrippa II coming in, kind of along the lines there. And you look at that political landscape in that short period of time, and it is an absolute minefield to try to get that information right. And again, if you're making all of this up 100 years later in a different part of the world, and you're just, you know, just guessing, there's no way you can get all of that right. I mean, try to describe the political situation of the city of Tampa 150 years ago. Anyone want to take a stab at that? Let's all get together and make up a story, and we're going to pass it off as fact and talk about the political situation in this city 150 years ago. I mean, we've got Wikipedia, and we couldn't even do that very well. And so here, before the internet is around, they're able to, you know, navigate this minefield sure-footedly without ever misstepping. They get all of the information right about all of these people all along the ways. And it's, you know, you look at the false gospels, the gospel of Thomas, the gospel of Judas, and those kinds of things, and they are so filled with historical errors that it's ridiculous that the modern media tries to pass them off as being alternate gospel accounts. They're just filled with flaws. There's a fellow named Philostratus who wrote about the life of Apollonius. And at one point, this is someone who's roughly a contemporary of Jesus, who some people say was the real Messiah, that kind of thing. But when Philostratus is writing about his life later on, at some point he has him go to Babylon to meet with the king of Babylon. Which you think, Babylon, that was destroyed. You know, there's no Babylon of any significance in that day. Well, in Philostratus' day, it was starting to regain some traction again, and he just presumed that it was always a powerful city, and so he botches that kind of historical detail. But the gospel authors don't make those kinds of mistakes, and you see that in a variety of ways. We'll look at a few of those, beginning with Josephus and where he intersects with the gospels and what we can tell. Let's go back to that idea of the execution of John and the motive of John's execution. Again, in Josephus' account, it has to do with Herod's temper. It has to do with his fear of an uprising. And that's what motivates him to kill John the Baptist. That's a perfectly reasonable thing for a historian to suppose was the reason. Here is someone who's gaining a following out in the wilderness. And Herod, especially the Herodian family, they are notorious for being fickle and violent and evil and wiping out anybody that would be in contrast with them. And so it makes perfect sense for that to be Herod's reason. And so I presume that's why Josephus said that was Herod's reason. Now, the gospel accounts say something different is the motive. What's the motive for the execution of John in the gospel account? Say Matthew 14's account of that. Herodias. She's the one who is behind the execution of John the Baptist. Why is Herodias so upset with John the Baptist?
He called her an adulteress.
Yeah, there is this marriage situation. Herodias used to be married to Philip, the brother of Antipas, and Antipas got Herodias as his wife now, and John said, "This is not right," and Herodias got upset, and she had John killed. That sounds like a lot of inside information. How on earth could the gospel authors have had that kind of inside information about what was going on that would stand in such stark contrast with the account of Josephus? And you find the answer to that in Luke. And it's a striking passage because it's one of those passages you read right past without ever thinking anything about it. It's just kind of a list of names and you kind of, you know, fly through them real quick. Don't think that much about it or what the value is. It's also striking in this regard because Luke's purpose here is not at all to say anything about the execution of John the Baptist. So there's no way that this is contrived to come up with some kind of evidence. It's not like Matthew, Mark, and Luke got together over a cup of coffee and said, how are we going to contrive our Gospels so that they can all interlock with one another in such a way that proves this story that we're all making up together. But in Luke chapter 8 and verse 3, you read about the women who followed Jesus. Mary, called Magdalene, from whom seven demons had gone out, and Joanna, the wife of Chusa, Herod's household manager, and Susanna, and many others who provided for them out of their means. Well, the wife of Herod's household manager was a follower of Jesus. How is it, do you think, that Matthew got this information that Josephus was not privy to? Well, maybe it's from this woman who has inside information about what's going on in the household of Herod. And again, this is not in the context of John the Baptist's death. This is not the sort of thing where Luke is contriving some little detail in order to explain something somewhere else. What you have here is a really good picture of how history works. You've got two different accounts that interlock with one another in ways that are not necessarily designed to do so. This is your first hint at what we'll talk about later when we talk about undesigned coincidences. The gospel stories interlock in ways that show the truth of the narrative, even though they're not trying to show the truth of the narrative. But they do anyway. So that's what's going on here. Something else about John's death is John's executioner. Over in Mark's account of the execution of John the Baptist, Mark uses a specific Greek term that refers to a military officer. So it just says in Mark 6:27, your translation probably says something like, immediately the king sent an executioner with orders to bring John's head. He went and beheaded him in the prison. The term refers to a military officer. And that's striking because there is a different term that is used to talk about the civic officer, who is usually the executioner. And it raises the question of why he would use this term to talk about this military person to execute John instead of the normal guy who would be doing the executing. And the answer to that is provided by the Josephus quote. If you remember, Josephus tells us that Antipas was at war. And he was not at home in his palace, but he was in a military fortress where he would no doubt be surrounded by soldiers. And so he appropriately uses a soldier to execute John the Baptist. And it's just the small little detail that shows us that Mark is accurate in what's going on. Incidentally, the reason why Antipas is at war is because his ex-wife, her dad isn't very happy. He was in a political marriage with the princess of Syria, and then he went and got Herodias. And so not only is John saying things are bad, not only is Philip probably unhappy, but the first princess went home to her dad, and now he's mad too. And so this is why there's this war going on. And this also, incidentally, confirms the basic gospel account that this happened between Herod and Herodias, and that John would have been preaching this kind of thing along the way. All right, any questions about Josephus and John the Baptist execution and the historical points there? Yes.
We don't know if her daughter's name was Salome, do we?
I don't know if there's any extra biblical evidence on her name or not. Her name is Salome or Salome in the gospel accounts. I'm not sure what else there is outside. I've not looked into that specifically. All right, we're running out of time in a hurry. Let's see. We could probably get through a couple more of these, come back and pick up the rest later. The first one of these has to do with the move of the Joseph family to Galilee rather than back to Bethlehem in Judea, where you might have expected them to go back to. But in Matthew chapter 2, in verse 22, you read, if I can turn to Matthew 2 and talk at the same time. When he heard that Archelaus was reigning over Judea in the place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there, and being warned in a dream, he withdrew to the district of Galilee. And this goes on, Matthew says, to fulfill a prophecy that that's why he was going to be there. Well, why is it that he would be afraid to go back to Judea just because Archelaus is on the throne? Well, this is where you have to know the history of what's going on in the world as well. To summarize, shortly before his death, Herod the Great killed some Jews, and that upset a lot of people. And right after that, Archelaus is taken the throne, his son has taken the throne, and Passover comes. And hundreds and thousands of Jews descend upon Jerusalem for this Passover. There's always a lot of Jews in Jerusalem for Passover. It seems there was an even bigger number this year. They were very upset about what happened to the Jews under Herod the Great. And there is a conflict that arises at the temple that leads to a group of Jews, just because of their sheer number, overpowering a bunch of Roman soldiers, and they stone them to death outside the temple. Well, Archelaus is upset about this, and so what Archelaus does is he besieges the temple, he traps 3,000 Jews inside the temple, and kills them all. And then he sends people all over town saying, Passover is canceled, go home. You think about that, that's a pretty remarkable thing. And so one of the biggest Passovers ever ends in bloodshed, Passover being canceled, and everyone going their separate way. Joseph is down in Egypt, and he's on his way back at this point. Who do you think Joseph might have met along the way, if not lots of Jews on the road back? And he probably asked, what happened? Why aren't you at Passover? and they tell the story. All we know from the gospel account is Joseph heard that Archelaus was reigning over Judea, and he was afraid to go there. Why do you think Joseph might have been afraid to go back to Judea when he heard Archelaus was on the throne in the historical context? Yeah, I mean, he left Judea because there was a homicidal maniac on the throne. And now, on his way back, he finds out there's a homicidal maniac on the throne. And so he says, let's not go back there. He's warned in a dream, and he goes instead to Galilee. And the detail itself is illustrated and confirmed and clarified by this extra-biblical account that we find in Josephus. All right, one other thing that I'll mention today King Herod. Now, this is not the kind of thing you hear quite so much today. It's been pretty conclusively proven wrong. But if some skeptic comes across this quote, and they see it on the internet, and they have as much sense as most people on the internet who argue, they'll probably run with it, and you need to know about this. Thomas Paine said there could not have been such a person as King Herod, because the Jews in their country were then under the dominion of the Roman emperors, who were governed then by tetrarchs or governors. And so the gospel accounts are wrong because they call him a king when he was clearly not a king. He couldn't have been a king because the king was in Rome, not in Judea. And it sounds very plausible. It sounds very reasonable to a skeptical mind that is not well-versed in history. It sounds fantastic. And to a believer who's not well-versed in history, it sounds a little, damaging perhaps. So let's talk about the King Herods that we find in the Bible. There is Herod the Great, who is called a king in Matthew chapter 2. There is Archelaus, who is not called a king, but it says he was reigning as king. Incidentally, one of the problems that the Romans had with Archelaus is that he assumed the throne without without Caesar's stamp of approval to do so. And that was part of what led him to being deposed, that and other things as well. But it's striking that the Bible doesn't tell us he was king. It says he was reigning as king. It kind of fits that detail. And then Agrippa the First is called a king as well. Now, Josephus says about Agrippa the First, no time in the previous 30 years, nor ever afterward, when there was there king in Jerusalem, except these last 3 years of the life of Agrippa the First. So Josephus says Agrippa was a king, and Josephus says 30 years before that, there was a king. And so you have at least some confirmation in Josephus about these two kings, Herod the Great and Agrippa. But beyond that, we have other things. This is a coin of Herod the Great. And this coin, you probably can't make it out, even if you can read Greek, it says Basileus Herod, King Herod is what that coin says. So here is a very hard piece of evidence that there was a King Herod in Jerusalem. And then on top of that, there were other coins of Agrippa the First, Basileus Agrippa, King Agrippa. And so in addition to Josephus, who says there was a King Herod, Agrippa, and implies 30 years before that there was another king, you have the evidence of the coins themselves, the archaeological evidence that there was, in fact, a king. So, again, most people these days know this kind of information very well, but the ill-informed skeptic may try to drag that information out and say, oh, no, there couldn't have been a king, Herod, because they didn't have any kings back then. Yes, they did, and the evidence is pretty overwhelming that they did. All right, well, next time we'll come back to coins in particular is where we'll start, and some information about coins in the Gospels and where that information is correct along the lines as well. And then after that, we'll probably get into the book of Acts and the historical overlap between Luke's story and the information we have in inscriptional and archaeological evidence that confirms time and time again the stories in Acts. All right, well, thank you for your attention and comments this evening.